One of the most stimulating and exciting things about working for the English program here at Vatican Radio is that the range of subjects one can focus on is really vast. From the meaning of religious feast days, to human rights, to social justice, to the arts, you name it. So when I happened to bump into a famous sculptor during one of my visits to the Pontifical Beda College, I immediately whipped out my microphone and asked him to tell me about his work, his vision, and his background.
My name is Fenwick Lawson, Durham-born, which makes me a northerner, which has something to do with the, in a sense, the vocabulary of the sculpture.
Fenwick told me he was at the Beda College in Rome because he had just brought over his latest work, a more than life-sized Christ on the cross that had been commissioned him by the rector of the college. This Christ, he explained, had found inspiration in a painting of San Damiano, and it joins a work Fenwick did some years ago, representing the Venerable Bede.
It was Monsignor Rod Strange who suggested that you come into the Beda and where is the image of Christ in terms of introduction? So he challenged me to produce a Christ. I don't think he anticipated a life-size one.
He's very beautiful. He was made from an elm tree.
That is an elm tree, yes. The interesting thing, in one sense, it's a bit dangerous for an artist to, if you like, there's a danger in copying another piece. But then this is sculpture, whereas the source is a painting. So because it's an elm tree, it takes on its own objectness, which makes it, you know,
unique.
It is its own self, even though it has. I'm just paying homage, really, to the San Damiano.
Why did you choose the elm tree? You were saying before that you work with the tree.
Elm is a very vigorous tree. It really does assert itself. Something like the chestnut, you see, is quite neutral. Bede is the chestnut. But he was a seven-year-old when he went to Monk Wearmouth, which was the first Saxon church built by Benedict Biscop. Mm-hmm. And Benedict Biscop had been to Rome and was very Romanized. He was absolutely amazed to see all of this stone, you know, as opposed to wood. And
as you say, you yourself were when you first came to Rome.
Well, absolutely, absolutely.
So, but you know, the stone speaks to the sculptor as well, just as it does.
It's just that my temperament is more towards the nature of the wood, the nature of the tree, in its sort of vitality of growth.
So you were saying you give the action to the tree, you give the action to the wood, and what does the wood give you?
In one sense, I work with what the wood can offer. There is a duality between myself and the tree, but the tree often gives me surprises which I can then react to. I like that because I'm not totally responsible.
What are the elements? There's the shape, the colour, the texture, the movement.
It's essentially growth and movement. And in that sense, I am about taking the eye for a walk, in a kind of dynamic way. I'm an expressionist in that sense. I've modelled in clay, I've carved in stone as a young sculptor coming right through all of the media. I've worked in iron, steel, But wood, there's an empathy between the wood and myself, which is finally all of my later work, in fact, is working with the tree.
Is most of your work this large? They're life-sized figures we're talking about.
Yes, because the tree is in one sense a scale. You have a scale from the tree, and I respond to that scale bodily, so life size and more is what's available in the tree.
But Can I ask you something? When do you first see your tree? Do you see the tree before it's cut? Or do you choose the wood? How do you go about choosing your...
It works both ways. Sometimes there is one piece of work which is on Holy Island at the moment, which is seven monks. There's six monks carrying Cuthbert's body, just over life size. So with that, I had to source the trees. And each tree dictated the image of the monk, of the particular monk. So in that sense, the trees came first. Sometimes the image grows from the tree. But I have... I must admit that I don't have the full clarity of the image in my mind before I meet the tree.
And do you have the full image before you finish the sculpture?
No. It's like going for a walk. You don't know what you're going to meet, you know, but you respond when you meet it. And sometimes you respond with surprise. You might even see a fox in robe. You would be very, very surprised. So, but what I mean is that suddenly something happens when you actually take away the wood.
I hope that you too can see the picture, just as I could, as I stood there speaking to this intense man who loves trees. Although we were far from his workshop and from the tools he uses to cut, craft, model and smooth the wood from which his figures emerge, it was easy to imagine him at work with the wood changing shape in his fingers. Every now and then he would stroke the venerable bead's lovely face, and I noticed that Fenwick's hands had the same nuances and streaks in them as a living tree.
There's a little story. I carved a 15-foot Christ for Hexham Abbey. And when I actually went inside, this was so big. It was 15 feet. The reason why it was that size was that I'd helped Epstein with his Landaff Christ, which was 16 feet. And Hexham Abbey is 75 feet. So it was going to be up there, you see, above the medieval root screen, which meant it had to be that size in order to look life-size, 15 feet. So I cut the tree in half.
You actually do the heavy manual work, like cutting a tree in half yourself?
Oh, yes, with a chainsaw. I cut the tree in half, and I start to take the wood out from the inside, like a canoe, you know, to release the wood. And I got back to, let's say the tree was something like 300 years old. Well, when the tree was 150 years old, a branch had obviously broken off, and there was a little piece of soil in where the branch had been. I came back to that tree a week later, and there was a little fern growing out of that pocket of soil. So in one sense, there is a time and a life with the tree. So when you start to go inside, you discover and you respond.
I asked Fenwick if his subjects are always religious.
Yes, it's because I am who I am. I need to give voice to my faith. But I did find a problem with, if you like, what appears to be a religious subject very often acts as a barrier to a lot of people. And I would like my work, in one sense, to have the universality of its meaning. So more recently, I've actually taken a more secular approach, but still with the moral content. Let me explain that. When I saw the running girl in Vietnam, the child napalmed, I heard myself say, that child is being crucified. So I then imaged the child with the Edvard Munch scream as reference. I added a mother with the child with the baby on her back, running with the scream. Another child disintegrating, falling, and a child left behind. So that group is, I call it Bosnia, I call it Iraq, I call it wherever. So here's an image, which in fact is secular, but is crucifixion. So in one sense, yes, it is still religious. I've carved a hostage when Terry Wade was taken hostage, blindfolded, gagged, hands bound. And then that became the first station of the cross when I carved the first station. My daughter, my militant daughter, when there was a miners' strike, her sympathy led her to the picket line, and she was pulled off that picket line by her hair. And I saw that as a brutal act. So my first station of Christ condemned is having his hair pulled and a blow on his face, distorting his features. But so when you say religious, yes, or even the secular works are religious, but because they're secular in terms of media, everyone engages. Yes, you can engage with them from your own position.
But growing as an artist, Fenwick said, means having to learn from the elements you work with, as well as from the work of other artists before yourself, in an unending quest for truth.
I think it was the Pieta, when I was carving the Pieta. It taught me humility, because I realised that I'd bitten off more than I could chew. It was telling me that I wasn't really ready. I wasn't really the sculptor I thought I was, you know. And it was because I was trying to do something that I'd found in Michelangelo, which was his Rondanini Pieta, where I sensed he was dealing with the resurrection as well as the death. And to actually deal with duality was so complex. And it stopped me in my tracks. And it was 7 years before I find a solution to the idea of the resurrection coming through the death.
And you did finish that Pieta?
That's in Durham Cathedral.
Mm-hmm. And are you happy with it?
Well, I'm amazed by it. It actually went into York Minster. And it was when the roof was on fire, and the roof fell in on the Pieta. Molten lead ran down the wall on the brow of the mother, on the knee of the mother, but she was protected by a wrought iron screen. But Christ was on the floor, he took all the battering. And everyone was distressed. And when I saw it, of course, it had been enormously improved. It had a voice that I couldn't give it. It increased the trauma. So that's another example of if you like, humility. I'm not totally responsible, you know. It has my name to it now. That I think, well, I've got to add an act of God here.